The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 2, Side 1.
No one had ever yet observed such an arrival. The newcomers wore leather coats, fur caps, woolen and cheviot suits, fashionable shoes and Oxfords. By the 20th anniversary of the Revolution, this select group had already discovered a standard of taste in clothes which was not available to working people. Because of bad management or out of mockery, the camp authorities didn't give them work clothes and drove them out just as they were, in their cheviots and chrome leather, to dig ditches in liquid clay up to their knees. At the junction of the wheelbarrow run, one Zek upset a wheelbarrow with cement, and the cement poured out. A thief brigadier ran up, cursed the Zek at fault, and pushed him in the back. "Pick it up with your hands, stupid!" And the Zek shouted hysterically, "How dare you taunt me? I am a former prosecutor of the Republic!" And big tears rolled down his face. "What the blank do I care if you're a prosecutor of the Republic, scum? I'll push your snoot in that cement, then you'll be a prosecutor. Now you're an enemy of the people and you've got to put your nose to the grindstone." However, it appears that the work supervisor intervened on behalf of the prosecutor. Now, just tell us of a scene like that involving a Tsarist prosecutor in a concentration camp in 1918. No one would have dreamed of taking pity on him. It was unanimously recognized that they were not people, and the sentences they had sought for the defendants they had prosecuted had been 1 year, 3 years, 5. But how was it possible not to take pity on one's own Soviet proletarian prosecutor, even if he was dressed in a woolen suit? The sentences he had demanded were a 10-ruble bill and the super. To say that things were painful for them is to say almost nothing. They were incapable of assimilating such a blow, such a downfall, and from their own people, too, from their dear party, and from all appearances, for nothing at all. After all, they had been guilty of nothing as far as the party was concerned, nothing at all. It was painful for them to such a degree that it was considered taboo among them, uncomradely, to ask, "What were you imprisoned for?" The only squeamish generation of prisoners. The rest of us in 1945, with tongues hanging out, used to recount our arrests, couldn't wait to tell the story to every chance newcomer we met, and the whole cell, as if it were an anecdote. Here's the sort of people they were. Olga Sliudsberg's husband had already been arrested, and they had come to carry out a search and arrest her, too. The search lasted 4 hours, and she spent those 4 hours sorting out the minutes of the Congress of Stakhanovites of the bristle and brush industry, of which she had been the secretary until the previous day. The incomplete state of the minutes troubled her more than her children, whom she was leaving forever. Even the interrogator conducting the search could not resist telling her, "Come on now, say farewell to your children." Here's the sort of people they were. A letter from her 15-year-old daughter came to Yelizaveta Svetskova in the Kazan prison for long-term prisoners. "Mama, tell me, write to me, are you guilty or not? I hope you weren't guilty, because then I won't join the Komsomol, and I won't forgive them because of you. But if you are guilty, I won't write to you any more and will hate you." And the mother was stricken by remorse in her damp, grave-like cell with its dim little lamp. How could her daughter live without the Komsomol? How could she be permitted to hate Soviet power? Better that she should hate me. And she wrote, "I am guilty. Enter the Komsomol." How could it be anything but hard? It was more than the human heart could bear, to fall beneath the beloved axe, then to have to justify its wisdom. But that is the price a man pays for entrusting his God-given soul to human dogma. Even today, any orthodox communist will affirm that Svetskova acted correctly. Even today, they cannot be convinced that this is precisely the perversion of small forces, that the mother perverted her daughter and harmed her soul. Here's the sort of people they were. Y.T. gave sincere testimony against her husband, anything, to aid the party. "Oh, How one could pity them if at least now they had come to comprehend their former wretchedness. This whole chapter could have been written quite differently if today at least they had forsaken their earlier views. But it happened the way Maria Danielian had dreamed it would. If I leave here some day, I am going to live as if nothing had taken place. Loyalty? And in our view, it is just plain pig-headedness. These devotees of the theory of development construed loyalty to that development to mean renunciation of any personal development whatsoever. As Nikolai Adamovich Vilenchik said, after serving 17 years, we believed in the party, and we were not mistaken. Is this loyalty or pig-headedness? No, it was not for show and not out of hypocrisy that they argued in the cells in defense of all the government's actions. They needed ideological arguments in order to hold on to a sense of their own rightness. Otherwise, insanity was not far off. How easily one could sympathize with them all, but they all see so clearly what their sufferings were, and they don't see wherein lies their own guilt. This sort of person was not arrested before 1937, and after 1938, very few such people were arrested. And that is why they were named the call-up of 1937, and this would be permissible, but shouldn't be allowed to blur the overall picture. Even at the peak, they were not the only ones being arrested, and those same peasants and workers and young people and engineers and technicians and agronomists and economists and ordinary believers continued to stream in as well. The call-up of 1937 was very loquacious, and having access to the press and radio created the legend of 1937. A legend consisting of 2 points. One, if they arrested people at all under the Soviet government, it was only in 1937, and it is necessary to speak out and be indignant only about 1937. Two, in 1937 they were the only ones arrested. Here's what they write. That terrible year when they arrested the most devoted communist executives, secretaries of the Central Committees of the Union Republics, secretaries of the Provincial Party Committees, chairmen of the Provincial Executive Committees, all the commanders of the military districts of corps and divisions, marshals and generals, provincial prosecutors, secretaries of district party committees, chairmen of district executive committees. At the very beginning of our book, we gave a conspectus of the waves pouring into the archipelago during the 2 decades up to 1937. How long all that dragged on, and how many millions there were. But the future call-up of 1937 didn't bat an eyelid and found it all normal. We do not know what expressions they used in discussing it among themselves, but P.P. Postyshev, unaware that he himself was destined to go the same way, spoke like this. In 1931, at the Conference of Justice Officials, while retaining our penal policy in all its severity and cruelty in relation to the class enemy and to déclassé offshoots, déclassé offshoots? How priceless. Just about anybody could be classified as a déclassé offshoot. In 1932, it is understandable that in putting them through the crucible of dé-kulakization, we must never lose sight of the fact that this kulak of yesterday is not morally disarmed. And again, in no case must the sharp blade of penal policy become dull. And that blade, Pavel Petrovich, was so sharp, and that crucible so very hot. R. M. Gehr explained it like this. So long as the arrests involved people who were unknown or scarcely known to me, I and my acquaintances had no doubts about the well-foundedness of those arrests. But when people close to me were arrested and I myself was arrested, and when I encountered dozens of the most loyal communists in prison, then, in a word, they remained calm while society was being imprisoned. Their outraged reason boiled when their own fellowship began to be imprisoned. Stalin violated a taboo that appeared firmly established, and that was why they had led such a gay life. Of course, they were stunned. Of course, it was a fantastic thing to have to grasp. And in the cells they asked heatedly, "Comrades, do you know whose coup this was? Who seized power in our city?" And for a long time after, As they became convinced of the irrevocability of their fate, they sighed and groaned. If only Lenin were alive, this never would have happened. What did they mean by this? Was it not precisely this that had happened to the others before them? See Part 1, Chapters 8 and 9. But nonetheless, they were government people, enlightened Marxists, theoreticians. And how did they cope with this ordeal? How did they reprocess and make sense of an historical event not previously digested nor explained in the newspapers? And historical events always swoop down unexpectedly. Dragged roughly for years down a false trail, they offered explanations astonishing in their profundity. One, it is the very cunning work of foreign intelligence services. Two, it is wrecking on an enormous scale. Wreckers have taken over the NKVD. A variation on this was German agents had taken over the NKVD. Three, it is a plot by local NKVD men. And in all three cases the message was that we ourselves were to blame for relaxing our vigilance. Stalin doesn't know anything. Stalin doesn't know about these arrests. When he finds out, he will destroy them all and free us. Four, in the ranks of the party there was terrible treason. But why? And the entire country is teeming with enemies, and the majority of the people here have been correctly arrested. They aren't communists, but counter-revolutionaries. And in the cells you have to take precautions and be careful not to speak in their presence. I am the only one here who is completely innocent. Well, you too, maybe. This was the variation which was adopted by Mekhanoshin, a former member of the Revolutionary War Council. In other words, let him out, give him his way, and see how many he arrests. Five. These repressions are an historical necessity for the development of our society. This was how a few of the theoreticians talked, who had not lost their self-possession, as, for example, a professor from the Plekhanov Institute of National Economy. The explanation was a sure one, and one had to admire how quickly and correctly he had understood it. But none of them ever explained what laws they had in mind, and they just kept blowing on the same flute from their permanent selection. The historical necessity of development. You can spout that nonsense about anything, and you'll always be right. And in all five variations, no one, of course, accused Stalin. He remained an uneclipsed sun. And against the background of these astonishing explanations, that particular one which Narokov, Marchenko, in his novel Mnimye Velichini, Imaginary Values, ascribes to his characters, seems psychologically very possible, that all these arrests were simply a show put on to test the true Stalinists. You had to do everything demanded of you, and whoever would sign everything without becoming embittered would be promoted substantially later on. And if one day one of the old party members, like, for example, Alexander Ivanovich Yashkevich, the Byelorussian censor, wheezed from the corner of the cell that Stalin was no right hand of Lenin but a dog, and until he croaked nothing good would happen, they would hurl themselves on such a person with fists and hurry to denounce him to their interrogator. It is impossible to imagine to oneself a good thinker who for one moment in a daydream would let out a peep about the death of Stalin. Right on that level of inquisitive thought is where the year 1937 caught up with the loyalist orthodox communists. And what kind of an attitude to their trial were they left with? Evidently like Parsons in Orwell's 1984. You don't think the party would arrest an innocent man? Thank you, I'm going to say to the tribunal. Thank you for saving me before it was too late. And what way out did they find for themselves? What active decision did their revolutionary theory indicate? Their decision is just as priceless as their explanations. Here is what it is. The more people that are arrested, the quicker those at the top are going to understand their mistake. And therefore, one has to try to name as many names as possible. One has to give as much fantastic testimony as possible against innocence. They won't arrest the entire party. But Stalin didn't need the whole party. All he needed was its leadership and the members with seniority. just as out of the members of all the Russian parties it was the communists who turned out to be the first to give false testimony against themselves, so too they were the first to make the merry-go-round discovery that you should name as many names as possible. Well, perhaps the Union Bureau of Mensheviks preceded them, but they, on the basis of their convictions, were almost Bolsheviks. Russian revolutionaries had never heard of anything like that. Was it their short-sightedness that showed itself in this theory? The poverty of their ideas? I sense instinctively that this was not the case, that what moved them here was fear, and that this theory was only a handy camouflage to cover up their weakness, for after all they called themselves, long since unlawfully, revolutionaries, but when they looked inside themselves they shuddered. It turned out that they were incapable of standing up to the interrogator. And this theory freed them from the necessity of struggling against the interrogator. They ought to have been able to understand at least this, that for Stalin this purge of the party was necessary in order to downgrade the party in comparison with himself, for he himself did not have the genius to rise in comparison with the party, even such as it was. Of course, they did not remember how very recently they themselves had helped Stalin destroy the opposition. Yes, and even themselves, too. After all, Stalin gave his own weak-willed victims the opportunity of taking a chance and rebelling, for this game was not without its satisfactions for him. To arrest each member of the Central Committee required the sanction of all the others. That is something the playful tiger thought up, and while the sham plenums and conferences proceeded, a paper was passed along the rows which stated impersonally that materials had been received compromising a certain individual, and it was requested that consent be given, or refused, to his expulsion from the Central Committee. And someone else watched to see whether the person reading this paper held it for a long time, and they all signed their names. And that was how the Central Committee of the All Union Communist Party, Bolsheviks, shot itself. Stalin had calculated and verified their weakness even earlier than that, once the top level of the party had accepted as their due high wages, secret provisioning facilities, private sanatoriums. It was already in the trap, and there was no way to backtrack. And who made up the special assizes that tried Tukhachevsky and Yakir, Blücher, Yegorov, and S.A. Turovsky? And they had forgotten even more, yes, and had never read it anyway, such ancient history as the message of the Patriarch Tikhon to the Council of People's Commissars on October the 26th, 1918. Appealing for mercy and for the release of the innocent, the staunch Patriarch warned them that the blood of all the prophets which was shed from the foundation of the world may be required of this generation, St. Luke chapter 11, verse 50, and for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. Matthew chapter 26, verse 52. But at that time it seemed absurd, impossible. How could they imagine at that time that history sometimes does know revenge, a sort of voluptuous and delayed justice, but chooses strange forms for it and unexpected executors of its will? And though, when the young Tukhachevsky returned victorious from suppressing the devastated Tambov peasants, there was no Maria Spiridovnova waiting at the station to put a bullet through his head, it was done 16 years later by the Georgian priest who never graduated. And though the curses of the women and children shot in the Crimean spring of 1921, as Voloshin has told us, were incapable of piercing the breast of Bela Kun, this was done by his own comrade in the Third International. And so it was with Peters, Latsis, Bertzin, Agronov, Prokofiev, Balitsky, Artudzov, Chudnovsky, Dybenko, Uborevich, Bubnov, Alafuzzo, Alksnis, Arenstam, Geker, Getis, Yegorov, Zhloba, Koftyuk, Kork, Kutyakov, Primakov, Putna, E. Sablin, Feldman, R. Eidemann, and Unschlicht, Yanukidze, Nevsky, Steklov, Lomov, Kaktin, Kosior, Rodzutak, Gikalo, Goloded, Schlichter, Beloborodov, Pyatakov, and Zinoviev. All were executed by the little red-headed butcher. And it would take a patient search on our part to track down now what they had set their hands and signatures to over the 15 or 20 preceding years. Fight back? Not one of them tried to fight back. If they say it was difficult to fight back in Yezhov's cells, why didn't they begin to fight the day before their arrest? Was it really unclear where things were going? That means their whole prayer was that they themselves should be bypassed. Why did Orjonikidze commit suicide so cravenly? Or, if he was killed, why did he wait for it? Why didn't Lenin's faithful companion, Krupskaya, fight back? Why didn't she speak out even once with a public exposé, like the old worker in the Rostov flax works? Was she really so afraid of losing her old woman's life? The members of the 1st Ivanovo-Voznesensk 1905 Soviet of Deputies, Alalyakin and Spiridonov, why did they now sign shameful charges against themselves? And why did Shubin, the representative of that same Soviet of Deputies, sign even more than that? That there had been no Ivanovo-Voznesensk Soviet of Deputies in 1905. How was it possible to spit on one's whole life like that? The good thinkers themselves, remembering 1937 now, groan over the injustices and horrors, but no one recalls the possibilities of fighting back which existed, and which they physically possessed, and which no one made use of. And of course they never will explain it either. Will Yevgeny Yevtushenko, full of energy, take up that task, the true grandson of his grandfather, with precisely the same set of concepts, in his autobiography and in the Bratsk power station, as those of the call-up of 1937? No, the time for such arguments has passed. All the wisdom of the imprisoned true believers was merely enough to destroy the traditions of our political prisoners. They avoided their cellmates who thought differently, hid from them, whispered about the horrors of the interrogation in such a way that the non-party people, or, God help us, the SRs, could not hear, so as not to give them material against the party. Yevgenia Goltzman in the Kazan prison, 1938, was opposed to knocking out signals between cells. As a communist, she was against violating Soviet laws. And when they brought a newspaper, Goltzman insisted that her cellmates read it in full detail, not just superficially. The prison portion of Y. Ginsberg's memoirs gives us frank testimony on the call-up of 1937, The hard-head Yulia Anenkova demanded of the cell, "Don't dare make fun of the jailer. He is the representative here of Soviet power." Well, everything had turned upside down. Show that little scene in that fairy tale crystal ball to the unruly revolutionary women in a Tsarist prison. And the Komsomol member, Katya Shirokova, asked Ginsberg in the frisking room, "That German communist woman over there has gold hidden in her hair, but it's our Soviet prison, so shouldn't we tell the jailer?" And Yekaterina Olitskaya, who travelled to the Kolyma in the same railroad car as Ginsberg, number 7, this car consisted almost entirely of women communists, supplements her rich recollections with two astonishing details. Those who had money gave some of it to buy scallions, and Olitskaya was the person in the car to whom they were handed. With her SR traditions, it never entered her head to do otherwise than divide them up among all 40 prisoners. But she was immediately brought up short. "Divide them among the people who gave the money. We can't feed paupers. We don't have enough ourselves." Olitskaya was stupefied. Were these politicals? They were women communists of the 1937 call-up. And a second episode. In the Sverdlovsk transit prison baths, these women were driven naked between formations of jailers. Nothing happened, and they were reassured. And in the ensuing stages of their journey, they sang in their car, "I know no other country where a person breathes so freely." Now, it's with that sort of complex of world outlook, it's on that level of consciousness, that the good thinkers started on their long camp road, having understood nothing from the very beginning, neither about their arrest, nor interrogation, nor events in general. Out of stubbornness, out of loyalty, or out of desperation, they would henceforth, throughout the journey, regard themselves as bearers of light, and proclaim themselves as the only ones who understood the essence of things. Having once made the decision not to notice anything around them, and not to draw conclusions, they would then try all the more not to notice what was worst of all for them, how they looked, this newly arrived call-up of 1937, still very decent in clothes, manners, and conversation, to the camp inmates, to the non-political offenders, and to the 58s, too. Any of the dispossessed kulaks who had survived was, right then, finishing his first tenor. Here they came, those who used to carry briefcases and look important. Here came those who had gone about in personally assigned automobiles. Here came those who, at the time of ration cards, used to receive provisions from special closed stores. Here came those who got fat at sanatoriums and womanized at resorts, while the rest of us, under the law of 7/8, were being given 10 years in camp for a head of cabbage, for an ear of corn. And so they were hated and told, "Out there in freedom, you did us in, but here we are going to do you in." But this won't happen. All the orthodox communists are soon going to get themselves well fixed up. Why, Ginsberg cites a completely contrary scene. The prison nurse asks, "Is it true that you tried to help the poor people, that you are imprisoned because of the collective farmers?" It is an almost unbelievable question. Perhaps the prison nurse behind bars saw nothing at all, and therefore asked such a stupid question. But the collective farmers and the ordinary camp inmates had eyes, and they immediately recognized the people who had carried out the monstrous cattle drive of collectivization. What does the loyalists' lofty truth consist of? Simply that they do not want to renounce a single one of their former values, or accept a single new one. Let life gush over them, surge over them, and even roll over them with wheels, still they won't let it into their heads. They won't accept it, as though it weren't happening at all. This reluctance to change anything inside their own brains, this simple inability to make a critical assessment of their life's experience, is what they pride themselves on. Prison must not influence their world outlook. Camp must not influence it. What they stood upon before, they will continue to stand by now. We are Marxists. We are materialists. How can we possibly change because we landed in prison by sheer chance? How can our consciousness change if existence changes, if it manifests new aspects of itself? Not for anything. Even if that existence falls through the floor and disappears, it won't determine our consciousness, for after all, we are materialists. That is the extent of their perception of what has happened to them. V.M. Zarin. "I always used to say to myself in camp, just because of fools," that is, those who had arrested him, "I do not intend to quarrel with Soviet power." Here is their inevitable moral. I have been imprisoned for nothing, and that means I am good, and that all these people around me are enemies and have been imprisoned for good cause. And here is how their energy is spent. 6 and 12 times a year they send off complaints, declarations, and petitions. And what do they write about? What do they scrawl in them? Of course, they swear loyalty to the great genius, and without that they won't be released. Of course, they disassociate themselves from those already shot in their case. Of course, they beg to be forgiven and permitted to return to their old jobs at the top. And tomorrow they will gladly accept any party assignment whatever, even to run this camp. And the fact that all the complaints and petitions were met with just as thick a shoal of rejections, well, that was because they didn't reach Stalin. He would have understood. He would have forgiven the benefactor. Fine politicals they were if they begged the government for forgiveness. Here was the level of their consciousness. General Gorbatov, in his memoirs. "The court? What had it done wrong? Someone had given it orders." Oh, what a profound analysis, and what angelic Bolshevik meekness. The thieves asked Gorbatov, "Why did you get here?" Incidentally, Gorbatov has them asking politely, which they would never do. And Gorbatov replied, "Bad people slandered me." No, what an analysis. Really, what an analysis. And the general behaved not like Ivan Denisovich Shukov, but like Fetyukov instead. He went to clean up the office in the hope of receiving an extra crust of bread for it. Brushing the crumbs and crusts from the table, and sometimes pieces of bread, I began to satisfy my hunger somewhat better. All right, go on and satisfy it. But Ivan Denisovich is charged with heavy guilt because he thinks about porridge and has no social consciousness, while General Gorbatov can get away with anything because he thinks about bad people. Nonetheless, Ivan Denisovich did not go wrong, and he has bolder opinions about what goes on in the country than the general. And here is V.P. Golitsyn, son of a district physician, a road engineer. He was imprisoned for 140 days in a death cell, plenty of time to think. And then he got 15 years, and after that, external exile. In my mind, nothing changed. I was the same non-party Bolshevik as before. My faith in the party helped me. The fact that the evil was being done not by the party and government, but by the evil will of certain people, what an analysis, who came and went, but somehow they never seemed to go. But all the rest remained. And ordinary Soviet people also helped me endure it, of whom in 1937 to 1938 there were very many, both in the NKVD, that is, in its apparatus, and in the prisons, and in the camps. Not the godfathers, but the real Dzerzhinsky men. This surpasses all understanding. Those Dzerzhinsky men, of whom there were so many, what were they doing there, just looking on at the crimes of certain people? Yet they did not get involved in these crimes themselves, though at the same time they survived. Miracles. Or Boris Diakov. "I suffered Stalin's death with acute pain." Was he alone? All the orthodox communists felt the same. It seemed to him as if all hopes for release had faded. But people are shouting at me, "That's dishonest, dishonest. You must argue with real theoreticians from the Institute of Red Professors." All right, as you will, as if I'd not done it before. What else was I doing in prison and on prison transports and at transit prisons? At first I argued alongside them, taking their side. But somehow our arguments seemed to me too thin, and at that point I began to keep silent and just listen. And then I argued against them. Yes, even Zakharov himself, the teacher of Malenkov, and he was very proud of having been Malenkov's teacher, too. Even he condescended to debate with me. And here's what. All those arguments seem, in retrospect, to have coalesced into one argument in my head. It is as if all these dogmatists, taken together, had been rolled into one person. Time after time he would advance the very same argument in the same words at the same point, and would be equally impenetrable. Impenetrability, that was their chief trait. Armor-piercing shells for iron heads have not yet been invented. In arguing with them, you wear yourself out, unless you accept in advance that the argument is simply a game, a jolly pastime. My friend Panin and I are lying on the middle shelf of a Stolypin compartment, and have set ourselves up comfortably, tucked our salt herring in our pockets so we don't need water, and can go to sleep. But at some station or other, they shove into our compartment a Marxist scholar. We can even tell this from his goatee and spectacles. He doesn't hide the fact he is a former professor of the Communist Academy. We hang head down in the square cutout, and from his very first words we see that he is impenetrable. But we have been serving time for a long while, and have a long time left to serve, and we value a merry joke. We must climb down to have a bit of fun. There is ample space in the compartment, and so we exchange places with someone and crowd in. "Hello. Hello. You're not too crowded?" "No, it's all right." "Have you been in the jug a long time?" "Long enough." "Are you past the halfway mark?" "Just." "Look over there. How poverty-stricken our villages are. straw thatch, crooked huts, an inheritance from the Tsarist regime. Well, but we've already had 30 Soviet years. That's an insignificant period historically. It's terrible that the collective farmers are starving. But have you looked in all their ovens? Just ask any collective farmer in our compartment. Everyone in jail is embittered and prejudiced. But I've seen collective farms myself. That means they were uncharacteristic. The goatee had never been in any of them. That way it was simpler. Just ask the old folks. Under the Tsar, they were well fed, well clothed, and they used to have so many holidays. I'm not even going to ask. It's a subjective trait of human memory to praise everything about the past. The cow that died is the one that gave twice the milk. Sometimes he even cited proverbs. And our people don't like holidays. They like to work. But why is there a shortage of bread in many cities? When? Right before the war, for example. Not true. Before the war, in fact, everything had been worked out. Listen, at that time, in all the cities on the Volga, there were queues of thousands of people. Some local failure in supply, but more likely your memory is failing you. But there's a shortage now. Old wives' tales. We have from 7 to 8 billion poods of grain. And not so soon afterward, Khrushchev would discover that in 1952, less bread grain was being harvested than in 1913. And the grain itself is rotten. Not at all. We have been successful in developing new varieties of grain. But in many shops, the shelves are empty. Insufficient distribution in local areas. Yes, and the prices are high. The workers have to do without many things. Our prices are more scientifically based than anywhere else. That means wages are low. And the wages, too, are scientifically based. That means they're based in such a way that the worker works for the state for free the greater part of his time. You don't know anything about economics. What is your profession? Engineer. And I am an economist. Don't argue. Surplus value is even impossible here. But why is it that the father of a family used to be able to feed his family by his own labor, and that now two or three in the family have to work? Because there was unemployment previously, and the wife couldn't get work, and the family went hungry. Furthermore, the wife's working is important for her equality. What the devil do you mean by equality? And who does all the household work? The husband has to help. And how about you? Did you help your wife? I'm not married. So, each of them used to work during the day, and now both of them have to work in the evenings too. And the woman has no time for the main thing, for bringing up the children. She has quite enough. They're mainly brought up by the kindergarten school and Komsomol. Well, and how are they bringing them up? They grow up to be hooligans and petty thieves, and the girls run free and loose. Not at all. Our youth have lofty principles. That's what the papers say, but our papers tell lies. They are much more honest than the bourgeois newspapers. You ought to read the bourgeois newspapers. Just give me the chance. That's not necessary at all. And our newspapers still tell lies. They are openly bound to the proletariat. That's the kind of bringing up that makes the crime rate grow. On the contrary, it's falling. Give me the statistics. This is a country where even the number of sheep tails is classified as a secret. And another reason our crime rate is rising is that our laws themselves give rise to crime. They are ferocious and ridiculous. On the contrary, they are fine laws, the finest in the history of humanity. Especially Article 58. Without it, our young state would not have been able to hold out. It's no longer so very young. Historically speaking, it is very young. But look around at the number of people imprisoned. They got what they deserved. And what about you? I was jailed by mistake. They will sort things out and release me. They all leave themselves this loophole. By mistake? Then what kind of laws do we have? The laws are excellent. It is the deviations from them that are unfortunate. Everywhere there is graft, bribes, corruption. We have to intensify our communist upbringing. And so forth. He is imperturbable. He speaks in a language which requires no effort of the mind, and arguing with him is like walking through a desert. It's about people like that they say, He made the rounds of all the smithies and came home unshod. And when they write in their obituaries, perished tragically during the period of the cult, they should be corrected to read, perished comically. But if his fate had worked out differently, we would never have learned what a dry, insignificant little man he was. We would have respectfully read his name in the newspaper. He would have become a people's commissar, or even ventured to represent all Russia abroad. To argue with him was useless. It was much more interesting to play with him. No, not at chess, but at the game of comrades. There really is such a game. It is a very simple game. Just play up to him a couple of times or so, use some of his own pet words and phrases. He will like it, for he has grown accustomed to find that all around him. Our enemies. He has become weary of snarling and doesn't like to tell his stories, because all those stories will be twisted around and thrown right back in his face. But if he takes you for one of his own, he will quite humanly disclose to you what he has just seen at the station. People are passing by, talking, laughing. Life goes on. The party is providing leadership. People are being moved from job to job. Yet you and I are languishing here in prison. There are a handful of us, and we must write and write petitions, begging a review of our cases, begging for a pardon. Or else he will tell you something interesting. In the Communist Academy, they decided to devour one comrade. They felt he wasn't quite genuine, not one of our own. But somehow they couldn't manage it. There were no errors in his essays, and his biography was clean. Then, all of a sudden, going through the archives, what a find! They ran across an old brochure written by this comrade, which Vladimir Ilyich Lenin himself had held in his hands, and in the margin of which he had written in his own handwriting the notation, "As an economist, he is shit." "Well, now you understand," our companion smiled confidentially, "that after that it was no trouble at all to make short work of that muddlehead and impostor. He was expelled from the academy and deprived of his scholarly rank." The railroad cars go clicking along. Everyone is already asleep, some lying down, some sitting up. Sometimes a convoy guard passes along the corridor, yawning. And one more unrecorded episode from Lenin's biography is lost from view. For a complete picture of the loyalists, we must inquire into their conduct in all the basic areas of camp life. A. Attitude toward the camp regimen and toward the prisoners' struggle for their rights. "Inasmuch as the camp regimen has been established by us, the Soviet government, it must be observed not only willingly but conscientiously. The spirit of the regimen has to be observed even before this is demanded or requested by the supervisors." There are some astonishing observations in the work of that same Y. Ginsberg. The women justify the cropping of their own hair with clippers, since the prison regimen requires it. From a closed prison they were sent to die in the Kolyma, and they had their own explanation already prepared. "That means they trust us, that we will work there conscientiously." And what the devil is the point of talking about any kind of struggle? Struggle against whom? Against our own people? Struggle for what? For our personal release? For that you don't need to struggle. You have to ask, according to rules. A struggle for the overthrow of the Soviet government? Shut your mouth. Among the camp inmates were those who wanted to struggle but could not, those who could but didn't want to, those who both could and wanted to, and did. When the time comes, we will tell about them too. The Orthodox communists represented a fourth group, those who didn't want to and couldn't, even if they had wanted to. All their preceding life had prepared them only for an artificially conditioned environment. Their struggle out in freedom had consisted in adopting and transmitting resolutions and instructions already approved by their higher-ups, with the help of the telephone and the electric bell. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.